Okay, so this afternoon, I guess, I'm going to be talking about the work we've been doing looking at these pulsations and trying to explain them. So first I'd like to thank my collaborators, which are Professor Siv and Professor Tanti, as well as Drs. Drake and Gia at the SickKids. I'd also like to thank NSERC for my support. So recent research, people have been looking at these pulsations, obviously trying to determine if they have any relevance to hydrocephalus. And our goal is to determine if these pulsations can have any sort of mechanical effect that may help to explain dilation. So the tools that I'm going to talk about today are a one-compartment CSF model and a thick-walled poroelastic model. And what the poroelastic model does is it gives us not only a space not only a time dependence, but a space dependence, so that we can look at stresses and strains and actually what is actually happening to the parenchyma. So the first thing I'll talk about is the one-compartment CSF model. And this is basically an extension of the work that Siv did in 1998. And they just have a simple CSF compartment that has compliant walls, and you have formation of CSF in and absorption out. So by the principle of conservation of mass, we just have the change of volume and time is equal to rate of formation minus rate of absorption. And because in the cranium we have volume is dependent on pressure, the rate of volume change in time can be written as the change in pressure in time times the compliance. For formation rate, we're taking a constant rate of formation, which I called IEF, and also a pulsatile rate of formation, and this is to introduce the effect of the pulsation. So the A here is basically the amount of CSF that's displaced by the incoming arterial blood with each systole. And the absorption rate is just taken to be the pressure difference between the compartment and some attaching body. I've taken to be the sagittal sinus pressure here, and a proportionality constant that is 1 over the resistance to absorption. So putting all this together, I get this simple differential equation. And I'm going to look at two cases. First, where the compliance function is constant, which is a first approximation, to our second case, which is where it's of the experimental form, 1 over k times pressure. So looking at the simple constant case first, this differential equation can be solved using the Laplace transforms with this initial condition, and this is the solution. Basically, this top row is a transient, and it's just the effect of the pressure at the initial time, so I can discard that because I'm only looking at the long-term behavior. What's interesting here is that I have a term that's exactly the same form as my forcing that I inserted based on the arterial pulses. So looking at that term, I can see that there is a phase shift that we can analyze, and if this 2 omega tau naught, which is the compliance of the compartment times the resistance to flow, if that's very large, then we'd be looking at a phase shift of about pi by 4, and if it's very, very, very small, we'd be looking at a phase shift of 0, which would be the synchronous case. So I did some simple simulations. First, I took values for a normal human adult taken from Shapiro's work in 1979, where the sagittal sinus pressure is about 12.2, the resistance to flow is 2.8, and the compliance is about 0.85. And using these values, the model predicted that the pulsations that were in the pressure are actually really, really, really small. They're not observable on a typical intracranial measurement. So I asked myself what needs to change in order for me to see what people measure in the brain. So I implemented these three restrictions. First, I said, I want a peak-to-peak amplitude in the pressure of about 5 millimeters mercury. This is just estimated from some of the literature. Then I said I want a mean ICP of about 13.5 for a normal adult, and I want to enforce the synchrony case, so there should be zero phase shift. And in doing that, I found that I do, in fact, see the the pulsations that are observed on typical ICP measurements. And my resistance is about the same, and my amplitude is about the same, but what I found is that my compliance now has to be 10 to the minus 6, which is a significantly smaller than what was estimated by Shapiro. And I think this makes a little bit of an intuitive sense because this compliance is the change in volume due to a change in pressure. So if compliance is large enough, the compliant walls will just change and absorb all the changes in pressure. So you're effectively talking about a rigid container here in order to see pulsations of such an amplitude. But I also asked myself, what could happen in order to observe these sorts of B waves or plateau waves that are sometimes observed in hydrocephalus. And just simply changing these rate of formations A and I and the absorption rates to functions of time instead of constants easily explains these waves. So the second case, I used a form of compliance of 1 over KP, which is what Marmaru found in 1978, basically that the pressure and the volume are related exponentially. So our compliance curve is basically 1 over P. This factor 1 over K here is the pressure volume index. So if I substitute that compliance into my differential equation, I get a Riccati equation which has this solution. And simulating it, I took again Shapiro's values of 25.9 for the pressure volume index, and I saw that I had a compliance of about 0.8, which was about similar to what was done in the first case, and again I didn't observe any significant pressure pulsations. So again I tried to reproduce what was observed in measurements, and I found that in order to decrease my compliance enough, I needed to decrease the pressure volume index to about 0.002, which gave me a compliance, again, about almost the order of 10 to minus 6. And this did represent, or gives me peak-to-peak amplitude of about 5 millimeters. So the conclusions that we draw from this simple one-compartment model is basically that either the parameter values that are being measured are not accurate or not accurately representing the closed cranium that we have when we're not invasively measuring something, or that this model is incapable of accurately predicting what is observed in the cranium. So I tend to take this case where what happens in the one compartment model is that the pressure everywhere is assumed to be the same. There's no spatial distribution in the pressure. Basically, it simplifies it too far. And if you look at the flow measurements, where they measure the flow in the foramen magnum about 5 centimeters at peak, and the flow in the subarachnoid space, which is very, very small, and recall that velocity is proportional to a pressure gradient, then obviously we have to have the pressure is dependent on space, because these types of models just can't explain what's actually happening. So where does this lead us to is the poroelastic or other distributed type models, like a viscoelastic model, where we can vary pressure in space as well as in time. So extending the work done by Kenyon and Tenti in 1999, I'm taking just a simple thick-walled poroelastic solid, and this represents very simply the ventricles and the outside is the skull, and we apply periodic forcing on the internal boundaries to represent the CSF pulsations coming in and hitting the ventricle walls. And what we find is actually very interesting. We see that these pulsations actually cause pressure oscillations, obviously, on the boundary, but what also happens is that a little bit of the CSF is actually sloshing in and out of the parenchyma on an order of about 500 nanometers. So this could help to explain what Levine talked about earlier, where you have shear stresses near the ventricle, and this sloshing of the CSF is causing shear stresses, which may explain in perhaps compromised cells how damage could occur to the to the cells based on this shear stresses.
Is shear stress in what direction compared to that angle?
So the ventricle wall is here and the brain parenchyma would be here, and we have sloshing of CSF in and out across the ventricle wall.
So allow the CSF to go through that angle?
Yes. Yes. Because the poroelastic material allows the flow, the fluid to basically seep all the way through the brain. So future directions that we're taking is, first of all, to determine what is exactly these mechanical effects of the CSF have on the on the parenchyma, basically trying to quantify how much or how strong are these shear forces, and would it be possible in certain conditions to cause cellular damage. The other thing I'd like to look at is determining if the effect of these pulsations are any different when the cranium is closed compared to when the cranium is open. Because when you open up the cranium and the doctors look at it and they tell us they're seeing the brain pulse like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's pulsing like that when the cranium is completely closed. So this would be interesting. If we can extend our model to a non-rigid skull, perhaps we will observe these larger pulsations. And finally, I'd like to extend these to look at sphingomyelia. Okay, thank you.